So Bamidbar, Parsha Bamidbar is the beginning of what book?
Numbers.
Numbers, or in Hebrew, I'm making it easy for you. Bamidbar, thank you. here, we need one of each. You got it? One of each?
No, just one.
Okay, so make sure you get both. Most of the chapter is about a census and about how to organize the people for the marching around, because in a sense, this is the beginning, this is the real beginning of the people Israel. Until now, we had the book of Genesis. Come on in, please grab one of each. There's one page in a packet. In the book of Genesis, we clearly have founding family stories. It's individuals, we're not a nation yet. The book of Exodus, we're slaves. We make it out of Egypt. And then between the middle of the book of Exodus through the end of Leviticus, we're basically getting the Torah and setting up the means for following the Torah, building the Mishkan for doing the sacrifice, following out the rules, establishing the priesthood. But we do basically all of that at the foot of Mount Sinai. That's all it takes about a year to get everything set up. And then Bamidbar is the beginning of our journey. In fact, that's why it's called Bamidbar, which literally means in the wilderness, often translated in the desert, but really we mean in the wilderness. And there's been a lot of books written on the necessity in hero journeys for there to be a wilderness stage, that if you look at hero literature throughout time, basically all heroes have some sort of out in the wilderness, away from home, not sure where you are stage in their process. Then you married well. She'll follow. She'll lead you on. So that's the begin. We're really at the very beginning of our journey, and so the first thing that we do at the beginning of this journey is we take count of ourselves. How many are we? And so, but the word used is a very weird phrase. There is a word for census in Hebrew, and that's not the word they use. So we're going to try and figure out what is going on there. And it may, at one point, we'll also ask, it contradicts another census we took in Exodus, where we're told not to do exactly what we're about to do, which God also tells us to do. But let's begin just with the words themselves. Does someone feel comfortable reading the English? It's the old translation, I apologize. Yeah, please.
And the Lord spoke unto Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first day of the second month, in the second year, after they were come out of the land of Egypt.
So, Joey, just pause there. So I want to make clear, that means we're 13 months since, you know, the 10 plagues and the splitting of the sea. And it's actually about concurrent with where we are in our calendar year also, because then the new year was Passover. So about a month after Passover, we're a little off, but pretty close to what we're talking about. So we've been free and at Mount Sinai it took 3 months to get there, another, 10 months or so at Sinai, building our Mishkan, getting everything ready to go, and we are about ready to be off. Okay, keep going.
Take ye the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel, by their families, by their fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male by their polls.
Okay, so polls is a weird word anyways, but take ye the sum, that is se'u et rosh, which literally means raise up the head. So raise up the head of all of Bnei Yisrael, by their families, by their father, so like, and give them designations. It sounds like a census, but it's a weird phrase, raise up their head. That's where we're going to spend most of our time trying to figure out what exactly that means. Keep going.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
In Hebrew, does it say the fathers, Levit Avraham means the fathers?
Yeah, the house of their fathers. By their fathers' houses, yeah.
Not no women.
It doesn't say no women, but their father's last name is what that means.
Right.
In a minute, it's going to say no women. We didn't get there yet. But it hasn't said that yet. Keep going.
From 20 years old and upward, all that are able to go forth to war in Israel, ye shall number them by their hosts, even thou and Aaron.
Give me the last verse, too.
And with you there shall be a man of every tribe, everyone head of his father's house.
Okay, so the ready-to-go war usually means male soldiers. So that's probably the easiest way to understand this is that, and remember, the people of Israel don't know that they're about to wander for 40 years. They think they've set up to go in, they've camped, they've built up their people, they've built up their numbers. And so the simplest way to understand the census is that they're taking account of how many soldiers they have.
Yeah.
Let's get everyone ready to go fight because we're going to go take Israel. And that's what's going on. Thanks. Victor's got it. Great. And it's also important to note, or it will be eventually important, that Moses isn't doing this by himself, that he's got a leader from each tribe. So it's got a good, you know, bump in job creation for the... That's my topical humor. Nothing? for census takers inside the tribes, yeah.
What does hosts mean?
Hosts are literally there. It's a military term. It's like a battalion. The stars are often called the hosts of God. The heavens and stars are the armies of God.
My mental picture of David when he fought Goliath.
Yeah.
That he was a lad, so I always pictured him as being about 16 or 18 years old.
Yeah.
Can you comment?
So maybe. Actually, the real expert is writing the book on it right now. Hopefully he's finished because he's due back like next week. but generally speaking, my recollection of that story is that he was not military age. That was the point. That the point of the story is he is too young to be fighting, and no one will go meet Goliath, and he decides to go do it. And that's what we get. You're right.
He's acting like a teenager.
Yes. All you old people don't know what you're doing. I'm 16. Obviously, I know how to solve the problem. And then, what's also annoying is how often are they right? Yes, one and then two, please.
At this point, has Moses already divided the pecking order of people over a certain number of people?
Oh, like the judges. So it seems, it's an interesting question I was thinking about when I was reading about the census. I haven't read anything on it specifically, but it seems to me that that is a parallel but not necessarily related system of ordering. That the tribes and their family and your clan, like family, clan, tribe, people, Israel, is the, like, this is what we're taking account of. And it seems to me that the judges system, which happened in Exodus, that yes, it's already at least hypothetically set up, is possibly outside that. It's not exactly related to that. I would suspect that you would not put an Ephraimite as a judge over, you know, a Danite or whatever, because like they wouldn't listen to each other. But it seems that's somewhat unrelated to tribal chieftain or clans. There's probably overlap because those are the people who are most likely to be trusted, but it seems like it's a separate system. Yes.
The word "host" is that a direct? I don't know Hebrew. Is that a direct translation of some word? Could that have been a different word?
Let me see. I mean, as we were just talking about, it's a military term.
Right.
Usually it's tsva'im, yeah, tsava, which means army.
When would this have been translated? I'll ask my question in a second.
1917.
Shakespeare used that word, host, for the exact purpose you're talking about.
Right, a little bit earlier.
The settings of how the military.
So I don't know. This particular translation is the JPS, the old JPS translation of 1917. But I would not be surprised if they were borrowing. Like I don't know what you'll find in King James from earlier or any of those lines. A brief digression. I taught at the Catholic Church at St. Paul the Apostle down the road. I did a What is Judaism Q&A, and. I always forget to be ready for this, but whenever I do something like this, there's a person who comes and says, it's usually a woman, I don't know why, but says, so what do Jews think of Jesus? I'm never ready for it because the truth is we don't think about Jesus. neither here nor there. It just, seems to have, just grab one of each before you sit down in the chair there. Did everyone get when they came in? Yeah, there's one page in a packet. Good to see you. And to like backtrack and try and explain, and then she was like, well, but the Old Testament proves that Jesus is the Messiah. And I was like, well, this may be news to you, but we read it a little differently. And it was like, oh, it was like really the first time it occurred to her that maybe they were different. And you're catching me on an off morning, so I'll go one more story in tangent because it's too good to pass up. Rabbi Harris likes to tell a story. He's the dean of the Bible department at JTS. And he was across the way is a Protestant seminary. And we overlap on occasion, especially for First Testament classes. And he was teaching one, I think, on Isaiah. And he was explaining how the grammar of a specific Hebrew word changes the verse depending on how you like read it and where you break up the sentence. And at the end, a guy comes up to him and says, "Rabbi, this is sweet, but I prefer to read this in the original." And shows him the King James translation. So that was a fun conversation. Which, like, if that's what you grow up all the time with, like, if you don't think about it critically, it's not necessarily unreasonable, but it is funny the way things happen. All right, here we are. We're taking account of the people Israel. We eventually find out there are 603,000, some odd thousand, a couple more than that. It seems like military age males, so above the age of 20. There's also another census that comes a little bit later of Levites, and that's anyone over the age of 3 months. So that's all males over the age of 3 months because they want to know who can be priests and Levites. So that's what we're trying to figure out. What's this about? What's with all the counting? Our simplest, most plain answer is the military one, which will keep coming up, is that we're just getting ready for war. But I think there is more here. At least I hope there is. Otherwise, it's going to be boring. All right. I want to begin on page 3. If at some point, there are two reasons. First, I think he does a good summary, but if at some point you are looking for a good, really readable companion to the weekly Parsha, Harvey Fields is a Reform rabbi. In fact, our kids, our bar mitzvah kids, get their Parsha Fields on their Parsha. He does an excellent job of summarizing the major themes, of bringing in different basically doing what I'm doing, but on a more condensed and very readable way, like a couple of commentaries about that theme, and he does it for every Parsha. Harvey Fields, I think he does the whole Torah in 3 volumes. I think he squishes some of it to get together, but he's great. And so here we're going to read his summary of exactly what this counting is about and what exactly is our question. Someone feel up to reading on page 3? Please.
Interpreters who study the words of the instruction given to Moses call attention to their peculiarity. The words are su and rosh, may be translated take a sentence, but literally they mean lift up or mark the head. As a result, their true meaning remains unclear. Furthermore, commentators point out that this census at the beginning of Numbers differs from another census previously mentioned in Exodus 30:12-15. There we are given no precise date of the counting. Instead, Moses is told to record the names of each person 20 years or older and to require payment of half shekel as an offering to God. By contrast, in the census of Numbers, no payment is mentioned or required.
Okay, so we have our question, which is, what exactly is going on here? Why is this different? And I want to, before we even get to any answers, I want to spend a little more time on the question. Which is, yes, on the very last page, page 10, source B. Abravanel is a sort of pan-European scholar. He was basically like the number 3 guy in Spain. He was Spain's treasurer, and then when the Christians took over Spain and began the Inquisition, he left and made it to Italy. He is interesting for, I would say, 3 reasons. First, he's a generally good commentator. Second, he really was a man of the world. So a lot of his questions a lot of his understandings are not esoteric, but are really grounded because he was Spain's money guy and eventually became Italy's money guy. I apologize. They lost my bag and told me they were going to call. I don't know what that means. Okay. Sorry. It just says 2013 is calling me. I've never heard of that. Just four numbers. No, I don't think so. What? Oh, great. So we'll leave them alone. And three, and perhaps most interestingly, he often, rather than answers questions, asks questions. And asks very good, pointed questions, the kinds of which we don't often see from rabbis who are often trying to give you answers. And here, he really hones in on exactly why this is a confusing time. So would someone be up for reading B on page 10, please? Okay, so we go back to Exodus and we understand that, in fact, you often, if you're a regular minyan goer, at some point you may find out that people try not to count Jews, especially after the Holocaust, that it got even more stronger, but you'll find people who count Jewish noses or... They'll say, because you want to get to a minyan, you want to make sure you have 10 people, or Hamotzi has exactly 10 words in it. And you'll hear, you know, them say the blessing, and when you get to Haaretz, you know you've got 10 people for a minyan. And that comes from this source in Exodus.
And in the old school, they used to say, when they count, they would say, Nishtines.
Right.
Not one,
right. And I've also, like, we're Jews, you know. We like to make rules and then not follow them, or follow them but not. Right. So the original one is Rashi's understanding of this first census. The first census, you may remember back in Exodus, we're told every person owes a half a shekel. Even the poor among you, someone who's living off of charity, has to give of that charity, is living off a half shekel to the temple. It's a way of drawing the community together. Everyone was responsible for the sanctuary. And in that time, it seems clear that they didn't count people. They counted to make sure, to know how many people existed. They counted all of their shekels. You know, and doubled it, and that was the number of Jews there were. And so Rashi takes this as we shouldn't count Jews. And yet here, Parsha Bamidbar, we're off into the wilderness, and God says, count every Jew. I mean, we're not Jews yet, because, you know, but you got the idea. Yes? Yes, so the speed at which they build up an economy and are able to be organized is often commented. In fact, let's do that one next. Give me 1 second. I left my notes inside, but there is one that compares. David takes a similar census, King David, and compares it. Yes, on page 7. Listing the names at the top. This is from the JPS commentary. It's a little small, so I'll read this one. From 1011, it is clear that the census was completed in fewer than 20 days. I'm sorry, this is like the fourth time they've called, so I'm going to just make sure everything's okay. Hello?
Yeah, this is Wade calling from Virgin America.
Yeah.
Yeah, is
this Jason? Yes. I'm very sorry. Please, yes, I'm teaching a class right now. Please, yeah, just drop the bag in front of our house, and I'll pick it up in a minute. Okay. There's no unit number. Just please drop it in front of the house. Yeah. Thank you. I got my bag back from the airline. You know, it happens on occasion. I apologize. I'll go a couple minutes over if you'd like to stay at the end.
No, you've got to go home and get your bag.
Yeah. Right. God willing. All right. It's a nice bag, you know. All right. So listing the names. From 1011, it is clear that the census was completed in fewer than 20 days. By contrast, David's census, which likewise encompassed some 600,000 names, it's about the same size census, took 9 months and 20 days to complete. The divergence is to explain by the different procedures adopted. David's census was laboriously conducted tribe by tribe, district by district. Moses, on the other hand, made each clan responsible for its own count. He and the tribal chieftains merely supervised. In this way, all clans were mustered simultaneously and their individual totals had only to be collated. The practice at Mari, where the mustering of the tribal population, that's where they are now, where the tribal population was delegated to the chieftains, indicates the antiquity of this procedure. It seems that the system continued to be operative in the period of the monarchy, for some Judean kings are on record as having delegated military conscription to each household. It goes further, even further to point, it's a fascinating just how fast and organized they are, and you might want to argue that that's why the book of Leviticus lays out such strict internal like hierarchies. Because very quickly they had to be a bunch of slaves and they had to be a nation. Not just a nation with someone in power, but a nation who could manage economy, who could manage war, who could manage functioning. They needed infrastructure. And so every tribe had a place to sit, and had judges down the line for each person. They needed systems. They needed people in place to keep the mechanisms of life moving forward. And it seems, at least from the Torah's account, that they were able to do this very rapidly and very efficiently. Yeah. You look like you're raising your hand. Yes.
Okay. I don't remember the parsha, but in second day of Pesach, the commentary on Torah at that point casts doubt on the number 600,000.
Yeah, it's probably nonsense. that's a huge number of people.
In a very logical manner, casts out on it.
Yeah.
However, here we are 2 months later.
Yeah.
And we not only get the number 600,000 restated, but
it's not restated.
Refined to almost an exact number, tribe by tribe.
Yeah, and it's actually much larger because the count out of Exodus is 600,000 people.
Right.
And now we're only counting 600,000 men, so we seem to have had a great year.
I think they referred to 600,000 men at that.
There's actually a commentary that I brought that says there they meant men and here they meant women. I don't remember which one. It might have been the other one.
Were the commentators of Exodus not reading ahead?
So it's a good question what exactly we do with these numbers, and it's always a question what we do with these numbers, because it's, first of all, there's no archaeological of people that large to wander in the desert for some period of time. There has to be at least garbage,
mm-hmm.
literally, around, and there's no archaeological evidence. There does seem to be evidence that there was a major break in Egypt at some point of a group of people who probably were monotheistic, who wanted to get out, and what exactly and who they are is, you know, we can debate and whatnot. But 600,000 is, you have to remember, world population was probably a couple of million. Like, we're astronomically large number of people. Yes, one and then two.
I understand that it's in the word that described the number that it doesn't necessarily mean 1,000, it could mean something.
Eleph.
I mean, Eleph means 1,000. I think that's Adah that you're thinking of. A different word? Maybe. I don't know. I've never heard that particular drash. Great. So, yes, I think for sure we shouldn't trust the numbers to be exact. I think the point is we were quite a lot of us. But whenever you get into the priestly tradition of sources, they're very obsessed with exact numbers. And you know this is priestly source because it starts with the first day of the second month of the first year. Whenever you get that kind of numbers, you know we're in that kind of line. All right, one and then two, and then we'll move on a little
bit. That's where Rabbi Wolfe got
Yeah, well, I'm not standing up on Passover for 1,000 people.
He was quoted as saying that the Exodus did not happen. Right. But he never said that.
Yeah.
What he said was the Exodus did not probably happen the way it's written in the Torah.
Right.
And he mentioned exactly that if there were 600,000 people of military age, there were probably well over 2 million people.
Right.
And there would have been some archaeological remains.
Yeah.
If you had that kind of a group in the desert for 40 years.
Yeah, or, you know, some other account other than our own. Yes, one, and then two, and then we'll move on. Yeah.
Looking back to modern times, we're talking about a very aggressive text. The rich and poor paid the same amount.
Yeah.
That makes no sense. They're out in the desert maybe 13 months.
Yeah.
Was the shekel Egyptian? What was the backing of the shekel? Where did it come from? Was it gold? Was it something they took out? Was it a piece of paper?
Okay, so it's very possible. It certainly wasn't a piece of paper. That kind of, I mean, paper didn't really exist. But it seems that from ancient economy that the metal itself was given value. So that's how, and it was weighed, like a shekel was a weight of silver, I believe, is what scholars believe what they meant. Whether or not this is later stories putting back on what was the case, that would certainly make sense. It would be very quick to have smithies made to make, you know, to make their own new money, but who knows? Yes.
For me, when we be counted as a Jewish in Exodus, coming from Ethiopia and the refugee camp, they count us and they check. They call it a blue book, and the name has to be checked exactly when you came from that tribe. Some of them, if they are not that tribe, and it was very difficult. And what I'm saying is this appropriate then when we study right now, they just count the family members, one so-and-so family have 10 kids, and they were saying that 25,000, but there is no money exchange at time.
Yeah. So you're 20 minutes too early for that question. It is very good. That's where I want to end today. You're absolutely right. What is appropriate for questioning and the nature of taking census? All right.
Censuses.
All right. Well, any of those, the plural of census, is there's a lot of power involved in that process. And so we'll spend that. That's the notion I want to conclude with. Yeah.
I take strong umbrage with the concept that there's no archaeological evidence because,
yeah,
first of all, yesterday there was more archaeological evidence that was
right.
Just discovered. Therefore, if the sentence doesn't end with yet,
right.
It doesn't. Yeah. There's no finality to this concept that just because we don't have current information doesn't mean that there's no information available.
It's true.
Available.
No, and the Sinai is not exactly the easiest place to go digging up at the moment.
Are you familiar with the Habu?
No. I'm not even sure what you just said.
Don't worry.
Okay. Yeah.
You've seen it in the movies.
Yeah.
Huge sandstorm, maybe a mile high, comes swooping across the desert and just devastates everything, moves everything along. It's like night.
Right.
If that happens, and it's common, a Hamsin type thing, in the Middle East, why is it not possible if there were those in those days that just everything far, far from...
So the only thing I'll say in response is, of course, yet can be for every known thing that exists, that's part of it, is that it is not just me, it is archaeologists who say we've done a reasonable amount of looking and we don't see so far any evidence, so far to have, you know, 600,000 to 2 million people, we probably should have found something. But let's put it aside, whatever it means, the notion of our story is that a large number of us that grew in number and that had physical might to them in the form of military age young men who were going to fight existed. I want to spend a little more time at the Su et Rosh, and I want to look on the very first page at Arama. I apologize, I didn't actually look up who the Arama is, but this all comes from Nechama Leibovich. Again, I've mentioned her on occasion. She was a famous Parsha teacher in Israel, and she was always famous for saying, I'm not teaching anything, I'm just giving you the sources. Then neither am I. So take it from that what you will. But he writes, it's also in little, in the middle of the page there, they were not just like animals or material objects, but each one had an importance of his own, like a king or priest, and that indeed God had shown special love towards them, and this is the significance of mentioning each one of them by name and status, for they were all equal and individual in status. This is important not just as a drash, but it's actually a crucial change of the Hebrew Bible of the ancient Near East. There is no notion of the individual. In fact, there can't be. For a society to embrace human sacrifice, individuals can't have worth. Because if individuals have worth, if individuals are all created in the image of God, then you can't stomach human sacrifice. Like you wouldn't do it. In fact, you see this most clearly with the Law of Jubilee. The Law of Jubilee existed in the ancient Near East and lots of other places, which is at the 50th year, all land reverts back to its original owner. But the difference is, in the other cultures that predate and coexist with the ancient Israelites, it went back to the clan. The clan owned and sort of divvied up amongst themselves. The Bible says it goes back to the individual. You get your original assignment depending on your clan and status or whatever, but you as an individual have your right to your land. It's a crucial change, and one way to understand this se'u et rosh, this weird phrase, is that we're going to count heads because each person's going to lift up their heads and be noticed and be counted and be seen. And that's what matters. So that's going a little deeper than the military one. Let's spend some time on the next page with Nachmanides. Nachmanides is nothing if not wordy. You know that he was relatively well off because he writes a lot. No one else has the time. All right. It was necessary for the Torah to record the total number after giving the details. We're on page 2, sorry. It was necessary for the Torah to record the total number after giving the details because Moses and Aaron had been commanded to ascertain the number of people and the number of each tribe, for this was the manner of kings to number their people. But I have now understood this reason for this commandment, why God ordered it, i.e. to record the general total. It was necessary to know the number of each tribe separately for the purpose of the arrangement of the camp according to standards, but why is it necessary to know the general number? In other words, every word of the Torah has, you know, specifics. And you need to know how many people are in, Issachar, and how many people are in Zebulun, because you need to know how much space to give them. But there's actually no real great need to know there were 600, 3,900, God bless you, 50 people or whatever. There's no great need to know the total number.
It's a may as well.
Yeah, so, right, may as well, add it up, I like that. But Nachmanides has no may as wells. He wants to know what's God getting at. What is the meaning there? Perhaps the idea was to make known his loving kindness unto them, and that when their fathers went down to Egypt, they numbered only 70 souls, and now they were as the sand of the sea. And after every pestilence and plague, he numbered them in order to make known that though he woundeth, his hands make whole again. In accordance with what our sages said, out of abundance of love for them, he numbers them frequently. So there's a lot packed in there. But you can the story of the Israelite people is that we're 70 people when we went out. And if you read through Leviticus and Exodus, there's a lot of Jews who die. In fact, there's one understanding that even in the process of the 10 plagues and the crossing of the sea, that only 1 in 10 survived. Okay. That 9 in 10 died in that process. In fact, Jews. That, like, it was that harrowing a process. In fact, if you've seen the animated Prince of Egypt, So they make, it's a recent take on the plagues in the Exodus story, and they make homage to this understanding. There is, I'm 99% positive, as they're crossing the sea, there are a couple of Jews who get stuck, and like older people, and they say, go on without me, and they do. It's like in a montage scene, so unless you're like really paying attention, you wouldn't catch it, but it's a nice, they had a couple of rabbis consult. In fact, one of my teachers who like started every class telling us he consulted on the Prince of Egypt. But regardless, and so, but it, people died along the way. So this is a, you're gonna begin again, but look, even though you've had all of these travails, these troubles, these wars you fought already, these mini wars, these plagues that have occurred, there's quite a lot of you. You should feel good. This is a chance to like be ready, to be proud, to raise your banners high. There are many of you, and not just there are many of you, but I, God, take care of you. Yes, I will punish, but I also take care of you and heal any punishment I might give. You can take anything. You might say he's really, God is, I didn't think about it until just now, but God is really setting up the failure of the first spies. So I'm almost positive it's next week. It might be the week after. We get the first spies, the 12 who go into the land of Israel and 10 come back and say, yeah, it's wonderful, but we'll never win. God is really giving them right now the confidence to actually go in, scout out the land, and come back and say, yeah, we could take them. If God can heal all of these other ones and help us with everything else, we can take these guys too. Yes, do you have a question?
I wonder if there's a Hebrew difference when it says, I will punish you, implying the individual, versus I will love you, implying the whole. Is there a
if anything, it's the flip. at least in the Bible, there's very, I mean, occasionally you get individual punishment, but more often than not, there is collective punishment.
I'm thinking of the words themselves.
Yeah, I mean, there's a host of words that could be for both of those. I can't think of anyone in specific that would differentiate. Okay, let's feel good. We're doing great. There's a lot of us. That's answer number one. We'll skip the next paragraph. I had further seen in Bamidbar Rabbah, which is a Midrashic text, on the text, with the number of their names by their poles, which is what we just read. That's our verse from Bamidbar. As follows, the Holy One, blessed be He, ordered Moses to number them in a manner that would confer honor and greatness on each one of them individually. Not that you should say to the head of the family, how many are there in your family? How many children have you? But rather, all of them should pass before you in awe and with the honor due them, and you should number them. That is what it meant. That is what it means when it states, according to the number of names from the age of 20 years and upwards, by their poles, individually. So in a way, what it's tapping into is the notion of parade. Parades are dumb. Like, what is exciting? Why would we parade around? Like, what is the purpose of that? And yet somehow it taps into a fundamental emotion of humanity, that to be seen, to walk out, to march in public has effect on the world, on people. And I can give you no logical reason why that, as opposed to like someone talking to you or something else. I mean, there's some publicity and things like that, but this is internal. But somehow, being paraded in front of your leaders, being counted by those that you feel are above you, is empowering, can help you raise up your head. Okay. Any other, sorry, did I see any hands? No? Good. Yes. So the word se'u et rosh, which is what we're playing around with, is the phrase, and it's what we're trying to figure out exactly what it means. You can generally, and maybe idiomatically, call it a census, but it literally means either lift up or mark the head.
Because it seems to me the number is totally recognition.
Right, so absolutely. So I think that's what certainly Nachmanides is getting at there, that this is by being counted, you count. Mm-hmm. Great, yes.
Again, in Hebrew, I know in English, a pole can be synonymous with a staff.
Oh.
Is that
right?
In Hebrew, could that be?
What's the word? Staff. 1 second.
It's a different word. I don't know the Hebrew. Name.
I think it's a different
I don't know this word. Legul Goltam. Yeah.
I can't imagine that they mean to take a number and pin an exact number. I mean, even in these times, people knew populations aren't static.
Right.
You know, by the time you start a census, people die, people turn of age. By the time you finish,
yeah,
the number at the end can't be the number you had at the beginning. It's just not, it's not possible. Especially with six, you know, with 20 people, that's true.
Yeah.
100 people, but with 600,000.
Right. That was the big joke. There was a while, I think it was last year, where they were saying the 7 billionth kid is being born right now.
Yeah, right.
It's like you counted everyone first very rapidly. I mean, maybe eventually when we all get, you know, barcode tattoos, there'll be some supercomputer that can count us exactly, but right. I mean, I agree with you. And yet we wind up with an exact number. So I don't know what to do with that tension. I mean, the usually when the Bible does this, you can argue because they give some whole number like 40 or 7 or 3 or 120. But this time they really give you like down to an individual number. And it's interesting to think about why they would do that when exactly you're right. And in some ways, it highlights the weakness, generally speaking, of the priestly source. So the priestly source, whether or not you want to, whether God wrote it or this group of priests wrote it, whatever you want to say, this style of writing, which is very, very, very detail-oriented, dates, numbers, facts, whatever, is often trying to prove the historicity of what occurred by doing that. Like, that's the feel of it. And yet, when you, the reader, read it, you often feel it's how unhistorical it sounds because, like, come on, what are you really talking about? You can't really do that. So in some ways, the message is, whether on purpose or not, to remember just how precarious it is to be in the business of history as opposed to the business of storytelling. That is what I think. But let's read the last paragraph here from Nachmanides. Perhaps in addition, it was also the manner of kings when going to war. Now the children of Israel are ready to enter the land to do battle with the kings of the Amorites who are on the other side of the Jordan, as it is said, as we are, right, we already went through that. So I think all of that is very interesting. I want to now take a minute with Hirsch. Samson Raphael Hirsch, page 5, is sort of the grandfather of modern orthodoxy. He's the one who says, it's great that the non-Jews are accepting us into their universities, into their towns, into their lives. Let's go study secular academics, but don't change anything about Judaism. Keep all of the laws, keep everything the same. We're somehow just going to make, despite the fact that there is drastic disconnect between those two practices, we're going to make it work. And the truth is, that's how a great, if you ask, like there are lawyers, professors, doctors who are modern Orthodox Jews, and you ask them, well, you are such a pragmatist in your professional life, how does that apply to your religious life? And they either can't answer because they don't have an answer, or they say it doesn't. And the truth is, I think that might be how most of us live our lives, more compartmentalized than unified. So I don't want that to sound like I'm dissing Hirsch or saying that what he's got to say is not super useful, but still, that's it is not what I chose, but that's the message. But let's see what he has to say. Someone else feel like reading? I've been talking a lot. Please.
Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch argues that the census was more than a means of bolstering Israelite morale or of assuring each person's importance to the community. It is not enough, Hirsch points out, to have your name listed on a register or to take your place in the line behind a standard. In Hirsch's view, the significance of the census is twofold. First, as indicated in Exodus 30:12, a mandatory payment, half a shekel, is required from every person for the upkeep of the sanctuary. Through this combination, explains Hirsch, we learn that a Jew is only counted as belonging to the people by doing something for the sanctuary.
So pause there. So the first census teaches us that being counted is not a passive process, that you have to own a piece of it. And that's why they count the shekels and not the people there, because they count who showed up. This is another way of saying, you know, people are elected by those who show up. Decisions are made by those, that's the phrase, sorry. And that's totally true, and that is one side. So that's one census, and this is he's subtly trying to answer Abravanel's question, which is, how can we have these two censuses that are so opposite in the way they function? One is you have to give the shekel and you count the shekel, and the other is you count every person. How do we have both? So skip a paragraph and then keep reading, where it says second.
Second, Hirsch sees more than a lesson of community responsibility and generosity in the ancient Israelite census. He notes that the census is arranged as a valuable model of community organization. The individuals first group themselves into families, the families into tribes, and finally the tribes into one common house of Israel.
So the second census, by contrast, the first census really highlights we're all exactly the same. Like we are a nation of individuals. And the second census, despite counting everyone, despite it being se'u et rosh and raise up your head, actually shows you your place in society. That you are not just you are you. Well, that sounds exciting. You are you, the son of whoever you are the son of. You are part of your clan, a part of your tribe, and eventually part of Israel, and that's what matters. And in fact, when we talk about the notion of being counted, that's what we're talking about, that you are, you know, have an identity, and you have that identity plays into the identity of a larger group, and that larger group has some weight or bearing upon yourself. So it's a two-way street, these two censuses. One is, you do something, and therefore you matter. And the other is that by existing, you matter to us. That it plays back and forth. The group gives you identity by giving you a place, and you give the group its strength by being an individual who gives the half a shekel. It's a really nice drash. Yes? Excellent. Great, and that plays into the military thing, that we're about to go to war. That's what they believe. People are going to die, but we're going to know which ones. Mm-hmm. We're going to know them, and we're going to have counted them, and we're going to remember them. In many ways, it's the problem we're often dealing with in trying to survive or move past the Holocaust, that there's a reason that the parks this year around LA are doing 6 million names and trying to have said 6 million names. But the truth is, 6 million as a number we made up. Like, if you go to any good history class by the good professor, they'll tell you we don't have any good count. And in fact, Father Patrick Dubois, who spoke last year, Murder by Bullets was his book, and he constantly uncovers mass graves of people who aren't counted. So maybe it's many more than 6 million, maybe it's many less. And you can't, from like in Majdanek, the camp in Poland, all we have is literally a giant pile of ashes. You can't count people from that. This is saying before we go to battle, we're going to know exactly how many we are. We're going to know who is who so that we can properly mourn and carry on and keep those names, not just in your family and not just in your clan and not just in your tribe, but in the entire people Israel. It's a nice drash. I hadn't thought of it before. All right. We're going to go back to trying to figure out what is the nature of census. All right. Let's start on page 7. I find myself in the last couple of weeks often wanting to end with this commentary, so I'll plug them again. Torah, a women's commentary. It's a green book put out by the Union of Reform Judaism. No, the United Association of Hebrew Congregations, which is a reform press, basically. And it's a very different angle while still being grounded in our texts. So it's nice big letters. Who wants to read there? Please.
Yeah.
So pause there. My daughter has this toy. There are gears, and you like plug them in,
yes.
And eventually you can turn one, and they all turn with how all machines work. And this is what they're talking about. This is what this comment is talking about, that by being counted, you are given one gear spot in the larger scheme of the Israelite people. And when you're in the right spot and connected to everyone else in just the right way, and they're connected to everyone else in just the right way, then at the center of it all is God. And then you as a people create space to find the divine, both by doing your individual work, whatever your work is, and by being able to share and benefit in congregation with the rest of the work being done. And this is exactly what we're talking about at the beginning, when this is on a spiritual plane that we might, but also on a physical plane, when everyone is in their own space. There's a great midrash about who's the prophet? Balaam. Balaam gets up and says, "How good are the tents of Israel?" And what is it that he's actually saying are great? Are they pretty? Like, what does it mean, "Matovu ohalecha Yaakov"? How great are your tents, Israel? It was that when they all 600,000 people or 2 million people, depending on how you want to count. And they each are in their own teepee. The doors don't face each other. Everything is faced a little bit different to avoid jealousy, lashon hara, and like just looking at, to give everyone both their private and their public space. That in this notion, the entire Torah then is about trying to give you a space as a cog, but not in the sort of bland, generic, post-industrial way of thinking, but in the cog of the greater machine of building a nation that seeks to uncover the presence of the divine in that which is ultimate in the world. It's hopefully a rousing stir to find your purpose and fulfill it in community. And now we'll get exactly to the concern about take a census. We turn to the next page. A census is a practical tool, but also a mode of enforcing power. Who does the recording and who is recorded are not incidental issues. Rather, the answers provide a form of centralizing authority and of creating a definitive hierarchy. The Tanakh records several censuses. Ooh, points for censuses. Tanakh records several censuses and in its characteristic way includes examples that express ambivalence about this practice. While there is something rousing about the emergence of organized troops from the newly liberated and still somewhat beleaguered people of Israel, other occasions of census taking unleash chaos on the Israelites. And there are a couple of examples. There is thematic tension between the idea that Israel should be numberless and the occasion of census taking. And in fact, that's the very drash on the first census in Exodus that we're trying to figure out how to work with. That we want Israel to be numberless. We only want to count the shekel. We don't want to count the people. That we as a Tanakh, anytime there is centralized and organized power, we're nervous. That's why last week, it's another way of understanding, we talked about God as slave owner. That what we're trying to do is take power out of human hands. Humans having power over each other is a dangerous thing. There is a reason that the founding fathers considered themselves in the Judeo-Christian faith, because sort of woven in between, woven throughout the Tanakh and throughout the First Testament, is this notion of being anxious about people having power over other people. Okay. But. Yeah, well, yes. He was all about trying to find equality, yes. Okay, I'm going to finish this last bit and then we'll wrap up with Kaddish. In military formation, the 12 tribes of Israel as Reuben, Simon, Gad, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Ephraim, Manasseh, Benjamin, Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, the tribe of Levi, forget about that. Rachel's son Joseph is represented in terms of his and Osnath's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. According to this parsha, the men of Israel over 20 years of age number 603,550. But the sum, yes, yeah, around that. But the sum is more impressive when one thinks of more than double the number of women and children. Exodus 12:37 counts the number of men who leave Egypt as roughly 600,000. Jacob Milgram suggests that the tribal numbers may symbolize astronomical calculations intended to present Israel as God's battalions, corresponding to the astral bodies metaphorically understood as God's celestial troops. So one last thing to tie the spiritual and the physical together, one last notion, that perhaps these numbers are given to us in a way that is would have been a part of the natural, the way that regular astronomy worked, or astrology as the case may be, that they would look up, and I said the stars were the armies of God, that we have these numbers because we match up to those armies of God. In some ways it's spiritual war paint. You know, we're going to scare you because you're going to know that we are the armies of God. So we'll end with the notion of feeling tense about being counted and trying to make sure we are counted. And certainly it's only been 20 some odd years that women have been counted in a minyan, and that's been a long and forever conversation that still goes on to this day. Rabbi Wolpe will continue the conversation of the counting, I'm using that very generally, of people who are gay and lesbian in our community, which doesn't even begin to address the issue of people who are transgender or any of the other sort of more in-between statuses. And I want to end where we began, which is with the question. Because the reason why the question is interesting is because all of these answers are good, but not quite. That this is actually a question for our lives, to figure out how do we count in a way that ennobles, that raises up heads, and at the same time give space for individuality, for individual creativity, and at the same time give space for feeling that you are just a cog in the whole. When we do all of these things at the same time, we walk that tightrope, that's when we feel like we're on our path to God. And it's not easy to do. That's why it's a tightrope. Okay. Until my son is born. He's due June 23rd, so I don't know exactly how that will happen.
Until he's counted.
Yes, until he's counted.